So, you know, the question that a lot of people have is the church started out all Jews, Jewish scriptures, Jewish God. The whole thing was Jewish. By the way, there also was a lot of power. Miracles happened. I mean, some Jewish people would walk around and under their shadow, people would be healed. Everyone was excited about Jesus. One day, a Jewish fisherman gives a few sentences and 3,000 Jewish people come to believe in Jesus. So how did it become so anemic today? My guest, Robert Heidler, is a specialist in this area. He's a graduate of Dallas School of Theology. Robert, how did you first get interested in this whole deal of the Jewish history of the church? Or this manuscript, this unpublished manuscript I have here called The Messianic Church?
Well, I've long been interested in history. I was a student of church history in seminary. But in 1997, I was asked to teach a course in church history from a Messianic Jewish perspective. And so I began to do research and I began to study. And the first question I had was, when did the church stop being Jewish? And like many Christians, I had assumed that shortly after Pentecost, they decided, well, this is no longer Jewish. We're going to have a Gentile church and set it up to minister to Gentiles. And so I went back to the book of Acts and began to study through to find where the break from Judaism came. And what I was amazed with as I read through the book of Acts was that break never came. There never came a point where they said, now we're leaving Judaism and we're going to become a Gentile movement. As a matter of fact, as you go through the book of Acts, they still worshiped in the temple and in the synagogues. They still took Nazirite vows. They still celebrated the holidays of the Old Testament scriptures. Even at the very end of the book of Acts, Paul is saying, I am a Jew.
So, did it happen, you think, in the first century?
Well, that was my next thing to study.
I mean, after the new covenant was finished, was the break?
Because I thought if the apostles never divorced the church from Judaism, where did it happen?
Yeah.
And you study through the second century, through the third century, you see the church, for the most part, still celebrating Shabbats and holidays and being very Jewish. And it wasn't really till you get to the fourth century under the Roman Emperor Constantine when he made the church an offer it should have refused. Because basically he said, if you will let me change the church, I will stop the persecution. And so the church, because of the persecution they had been under, they agreed and they compromised.
Well, what changes did he make?
Well, as a Roman, he hated the Jews. He viewed the Jewish people as a rebellious people that had been conquered by Rome. And so basically, he came out right out and said, we want to remove everything Jewish from Christianity.
So you're saying to me that God didn't remove it, the scriptures didn't remove it, but a man removed it.
A man removed it, a pagan Roman emperor. He wanted to unify his empire, and he felt the best way to do that would be to take Christianity and make it a little bit more pagan so all of the religions of the empire could merge together and be happy together.
It was a very political thing.
Very
it's like what they do
thing.
Today.
Yeah.
What effect did this have? Okay, so they got rid of all the biblical festivals. They got rid of the Shabbat, the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. What else did they get rid of?
It really got rid of a whole biblical mindset because the Christianity of the early church was based on the scriptures, Old and New Testament. It had a biblical attitude toward God, a biblical attitude toward the home, a biblical attitude toward the scriptures. You know, it's interesting, in the early church, their attitude toward the scriptures was every believer needs to understand the scriptures. Just like the Jewish people.
Well, look at how it changed over the centuries and the Catholic Church. It was done in a language they didn't understand.
Yeah.
I can tell you from Judaism, from my viewpoint, from this generation, I would go to the Orthodox synagogue and it would be in Hebrew and I wouldn't understand a word of what they were saying. So what about this whole separation of clergy and laymen?
Well, see, in the Greek mindset, Greek religions were mystery religions, which meant that the leaders, the priests, were initiated and they were able to understand the sacred mysteries, and the common people worshiped in ignorance. They weren't allowed to read the sacred books. And so when that mindset came over into Christianity, instead of having people taught the scriptures and expected to understand them, you had the priests who knew the scriptures. The Bibles were written in a language the people didn't know. They were chained to a pulpit where they couldn't be read. And the people would come in and worship in ignorance.
Now, when they would come in, like I was shocked when I read this unpublished manuscript, and you literally say that it was punishable by death if they met in the homes. And that's where the first church really met.
That was one of the things Constantine outlawed. He started building large church buildings all over the empire. And once they were built, he outlawed the house church. He outlawed houses of prayer and said, because he couldn't control what happened in a house church, but he could control what happened in the ones he built.
What about this whole structure of the Pope, the bishop, the elders, and then in Protestantism, they still have the same thing. They just changed the names. Where did all this come from?
Well, that is very interesting to study. If you look on the internet, and there's a lot of sites out there about Mithraism, which was a pagan religion. It was Constantine's religion. And in Mithraism, the priest was called, each congregation, each temple had a priest who was called Father. The high priest wore a special hat called a mitre. His symbol was a shepherd's staff and a key. And he ruled the religion from his temple on the Vatican Hill in Rome.
A great deal of authority.
Yeah. But as you look at the church 2 centuries later, the church is made up of priests. The rulers, the leaders are priests who are called Father, and the high priest has his church, his temple, on Vatican Hill in Rome with the same symbols the Mithraic priest
had. You say in your book, I mean, this is amazing, that many of these occult-type priests, pagan priests, they would take their temples and instantly one day it would be for pagans and the next day it would be a Christian temple. It was sort of like, this is the new official religion in town. And you know what? We went from a vibrant intimacy 24/7 with God to religion. I'd like to find out from this expert what the first church really was like. Don't go away.
Hello, YouTube. Mishpocha. Mishpocha is a Hebrew word. It means family. This is Sid Roth. Welcome to my world, where it's naturally supernatural. If you've been blessed by this show, please subscribe. Then click the bell so you won't miss a single episode of It's Supernatural.
Hi, Sid Roth here with Pastor Robert Heidler, graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary, who has studied what the first church was like. Now, why would we want to know what the first church was like? Well, they had intimacy with God. They heard God's voice. They didn't value anything compared to intimacy with God. They walked in signs and wonders and miracles. The least believer walked in these signs. It was not a superstar system. They all had the superstar inside of him, Jesus. And we found out that this fella Constantine had a merger of paganism and Christianity. And the vestiges are still with us today. So, question is postured, Robert Heidler. Paint a picture to me about what it was like before the mixture came in.
Okay. Well, Sid, let's imagine we're walking down a street in the city of Rome. It's around the year 90 AD, and you're going to visit an early church. Of course, they met in homes. There weren't church buildings. Doesn't mean a church building is wrong, but that's not what they chose to do. But we walk up to a house, and we walk in the door. And what we see is not like anything we have ever imagined church to be. There's no special clothing worn. There's no hymn books. There's no pews. There's no pulpit. The building doesn't have a steeple on top.
Crosses?
No crosses. As we walk in through the door, what we see, we look around,
Is there a platform built for them, at least?
Not a platform built. As a matter of fact, the church takes place in the large open courtyard, which most homes had at that time. And there was an open courtyard in the middle of the home. We walk into it, and it looks like there's a party going on. They're playing flutes and lyres and tambourines. They're dancing Jewish-style ring dances. And we look around, we think, did I come to the right place? This doesn't look like church.
They're really having fun.
They're having fun. It's exciting. And we walk in, and then we listen to the words, and we realize they're singing about Yeshua. This is church. And you read many, many historical descriptions of the early church that it was typical for them to begin with just a prolonged period of joyful singing, dancing. That was just a typical way for them to start church.
Did they have a worship team, so to speak, like we have today?
I imagine they knew who could play, and they knew
But I don't think they were all set on a bandstand.
They probably didn't have it. No. It was very free. It was very open. It was very joyful. And if that didn't surprise us enough, the next thing they would do would surprise us even more, because when that slowed down and stopped, the next thing they'd do is start bringing out food. And people would sit down together and have a meal together. It was called the agape. The New Testament describes that. And they would eat together. They would fellowship together. They would share about the Lord and the process. And because it was a family, they knew each other, they loved each other.
You know, I like to use a word, mishpocha, which is a Hebrew word that means family. And in studying your manuscript, that's what we lost by substituting the Greco-Roman roots for the Jewish roots. Mm-hmm. The whole family thing. I mean,
whole
it was so
concept.
Rich.
Yes.
I mean, I feel robbed.
You should. We have been. Things that God wanted us to have.
So they had this meal, and let me tell you, chicken matzo ball soup, potato kugel, you don't know, gefilte fish with horseradish, you don't know what heaven is till you've had Jewish food. Now, you don't have to like the Jewish food. However, what else happened?
Well, as they continued on, they would worship, they would sing, and at some point, and the Bible describes this, when the power of the Lord is present, there would come a time in the midst of this when the Spirit of God would just drop down in a very tangible way. And as that happened, miracles began to take place. Irenaeus describes even at the end of the second century, it was very common for healings and tongues, prophetic words, miracles. He said it was even common to see people raised from the dead by the prayers of the church. And the Spirit of God would, I sort of picture it this way, you know, you're sitting there and you're looking and there's a family in the back and they look very uncomfortable. They've never been here before. They have come because their daughter has contracted a disease that's left her blind, and they have nowhere else to turn to, but they have a friend that's a Christian that invites them to church. And they bring their daughter in, and when the Spirit of God falls, people gather around, they begin to pray for her. And suddenly she begins to weep and cry and say, I can see, I can see.
Could you picture her running throughout the neighborhood saying,
I can see.
I just went to Shlomo's house over there. It was so good, the gefilte fish and the chicken nuts of all soup. And miracles happened. Never happened in my synagogue. Okay.
And you know, soon the whole family's saved. And we think that sounds like a dramatic thing. But as you read, that is what saved most people in the Roman Empire. Even historians say it's the power of the church to heal and deliver that caused people to want to brave the threat of persecution
to come to know
this Yeshua.
In Israel, were many people becoming believers?
Oh, yes. You look at the church in Jerusalem, it started with 120, moved up to 3,000, by Acts chapter 4, it was probably over 10,000. It said there were 5,000 males in the church by that time. And many have estimated by the martyrdom of Stephen, it would be up to 20,000. When Paul comes into Jerusalem in Acts chapter 19 or 20, James comes up to him and says, look how many tens of thousands of Jews have come to believe in Yeshua and are zealous for Torah.
Can't this be recaptured again? I believe yes. I was so fascinated with this unpublished manuscript by Robert Heidler, we're making it available. And I believe that if we stop changing and go back to the way God created it to be, we'll get the same results. Makes sense? Makes sense to me. Don't go away. You're going to find out some mixture that came into the church, which is robbing us of miracles. Be right back. Hello, Sid Roth here with Robert Heidler. Robert is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary. His specialty is what was the first church like? And it's unbelievable. I got a hold of this unpublished manuscript. It is the most amazing things. It's all documented, and it shows exactly one of the things that disappointed you so much, according to this, when you were in seminary, is when you started studying the writings of the church fathers. That sounds like an oxymoron. Explain.
Well, Sid, you know, God had chosen the Jewish people to be priests to the nations, and he had spent 2,000 years giving them an understanding of the things of God so that they would be able to disciple the nations. What happened early in the second century is the gospel began to move out into the Gentile world. Men began to rise up into leadership who did not have that understanding. And a lot of these men are called the church fathers. They were originally trained in Greek philosophy. But they came to know Yeshua, and they didn't understand the things of God. They didn't understand what God was like. And so as they began to write, they would deliberately attempt to take what they knew from Greek philosophy and merge it into what they knew of Christianity. One of the first of these was Origen, who was a well-known early theologian. And his stated goal was to take Stoicism and Neoplatonism and merge that with Christian theology. Augustine did the same thing. Augustine is the father of theology for Catholics and Protestants, but his goal, according to any encyclopedia, was to take the things of Christianity and merge them with Platonism, with Neoplatonism, and make a Christianity that was acceptable to the Greek pagan mind.
How did their writings compare with the Jewish church fathers, the ones that had the mixture?
When I started studying church history, I was so excited to get to read the church fathers, because I thought these were men that lived just a generation
so close
after the disciples. They would have wonderful insights. And what I saw is they didn't understand anything. They quoted the scriptures a lot, but they did not understand it. And so much of what they said was almost laughable. One of the books called the Didache, it talks about how to baptize people and what's important. And its main point is you really need to baptize people in cold running water. If it's not running water, that's okay, but make sure it's cold. And that was their insight for effective baptism. They did not understand the spiritual truths behind it. They didn't know the nature of God. Philip Schaff, who is one of the most recognized church historian, said going from the writings of the Hebrew apostles to the Greek church fathers is like going from a beautiful, well-watered oasis out into a dry desert wasteland.
Was that your experience?
That was my experience. It was a dramatic difference.
Where did this, and you cover all of this brilliantly in your manuscript, which we have made available, even though it's an unpublished manuscript, but what I'd like to know is, it's almost outrageous, the fact that some people came up with something, a theology called replacement theology, where the church replaces Israel. All the promises to Israel go to the church. All the curses go to Israel. I mean, if when you look at the fact that it was Jewish people, all Jewish, a Gentile had to convert to Judaism and become a follower in Jesus at the first church. The scriptures were the Jewish scriptures. The Messiah is the Jewish Messiah. He lived a Jewish life. How in the world did the church fathers come up with this concoction of God's promises aren't forever when he says forever?
Well, that was Origen again. In order to merge Greek philosophy with the Bible, he had to find a new way of interpreting the Bible. He called it allegorism. And in that, he took the text of the Bible, but he didn't pay attention to what it said. He just put his ideas over it. And one of the ideas that he came up with was replacement theology. He said, we don't like all of this Jewish stuff, so we're going to say that God is finished with the Jews now, and all of the promises that God gave the Jews, he's now giving the church. So basically,
but there's too much scripture that says the opposite. Certainly there had to be people that said, no, you've gone too far.
Well, there were a lot of people that, but there were also others that were willing to follow it because they were enamored with the Greek philosophy, with the Greek mindset of the day. And it was a tragic thing because basically they're saying God divorced his first wife and married a second, and all of the promises that God gave to Israel, he just wiped away. And if we have a God that could wipe away promises like that, then we don't have a God we can trust.
What is your understanding of Paul in Romans, the 11th chapter? What is he saying to believers today?
Oh, I think
what is the relevance?
I think that's a very relevant passage for today, because what he's saying is this. He's saying, yes, many Jews have rejected their Messiah, but he said that's only a temporary thing. And he said the time will come when all Israel will be saved. And he said when that begins to happen, when you begin to see the Jews turning back to the Messiah, what that will mean is the Gentile church will be plugged back into its roots. And it says that will be life from the dead.
I've often wondered, when it says life from the dead, what does that really mean? What does life from the dead to the Gentile church mean? What do you feel, Robert?
Well, if you go anywhere in the world today, the church is praying for one thing. It's praying for revival.
Of course.
Revival is when the life of God comes into his church. Revival is a dead church coming to life. And I believe Paul is saying that when the Jews begin to turn back to Messiah, that is when the long-awaited end-time revival is going to sweep the church. And said, I believe we're just at the very beginning stages of seeing that revival take place.
Now, when you gathered all this material, what emotions really and truly went on inside of you? I mean, here you come from a Gentile background. You have as fine an education as a man of God can have in this generation, as fine a library as anyone. And then all of a sudden, your world is turned upside down. Like, for instance, when you found out about ISIS, explain that quickly.
Okay. What happened when the pagan temples became churches? The law was passed, you're not allowed to pagan worship was outlawed. If you're a pagan, you're now in a Christian empire, you need to live as a Christian. And so what they would do, they would take their pagan gods and just give the pagan gods Christian names and continue to worship the way they had before. And one of the most popular religions was the worship of Isis. She was an Egyptian goddess, and she was called the Great Virgin. She was called the Mother of God.
She was called the Mother of God?
And she's usually shown holding her child Horus, the god Horus. And it was a very popular religion.
Did they worship her?
And they would worship her. They'd go and bow down to her. They'd light candles. They'd light incense. And so what happened, the worshipers of Isis were told, it is now illegal to worship Isis. So what did they do? They just changed the names. That was part of the pagan mindset. They could change the names of their gods. And they looked around in Christianity to find someone they could change the name to, and they chose Mary. And so the cult of Isis, in most of the details of its worship, just transferred over, and they would go to the church that used to be their temple, bow down to a statue that looked very much like the statue of Isis, only now they're bowing down to worship Mary.
You know, Robert, that had to be such an abomination to traditional Judaism. No wonder there's a wall of separation between Jews and Christians today. But it's about ready to change. You see, mm-hmm. Paul said in the book of Ephesians, the second chapter, that the reason Jesus came was to break down that middle wall of separation between Jew and Gentile to form one new man. Now, this one new man is the King of the Jews, Jesus. And so you can see, I mean, it's so obvious, this replacement theology, this statues. I mean, in Judaism, we know one thing, and it's according to this Torah, you don't bow down to statues. I mean, the Christianity is the exact opposite of what we Jewish people were taught. And Judaism is the exact opposite of what Christians have been taught. But things are ready to change. I'm so grateful for this unpublished manuscript. You're going to get a copy of it, and you're going to change. And guess what? God is going to show up in your home the same way He did in these glorious house meetings that the first church had. Oh, you don't know Jesus? I'm glad you asked. Tell God you're sorry for your sins. Say, I believe Jesus died for my sins. I make Jesus my Lord. Live inside. Read the Bible. That's it.